We don't have a quorum at the current time, but we are going to get started here because at least the first bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. I'm going to call Representative McNamer up, and we are going to deal with House File 1970.
I am Representative Jay McNamer, District 12A. Thank you, Representative Chairman Mahoney and committee members. My bill is for that we received last year. For Denko to ethanol plant in Morris, we're looking to change the match fund from $1.25 million to $750,000. Mick Miller, plant manager, is here to talk to us today.
Mr. Miller, if you have a minute's worth of testimony, we'd love to hear it.
Sure. Chairman Mahoney, members of the committee, Mick Miller, General Manager of Denko 2 and Morris. Real brief, we worked last session on a grant for energy and water improvements. Senator Westrum and Representative McNamer helped carry us through, and basically we were working on a $1.25 million grant, and last minute changes were made. The grant was reduced to $750,000, and there was some basically, I believe, just oversight that the matching portion stayed at $1.25 million. Today, our request is to change the match to $750,000.
Might have just been a hope on someone's part. It was a dollar. Thank you, Mr. Miller. There was a representative here that had a question that looked like it, and we're really just keeping the same match one-to-one.
Correct.
But because our grant was only $750,000, yep, we're changing that $1.25 million down to what the actual grant was, because you were asking for the $1.25 million grant.
Correct.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a strange bill to me. I don't know how. I don't understand what side is the government side, what side is the private side. Are we talking about $700,000 the owners have to come up with to get a match of what again, please?
The state side is, thank you, Chairman Mahoney, just state side is $750,000, and public, the non-public side is $750,000. So one-to-one match.
Mr. Chair, and so why are we reducing the amount that the owners need to come up with?
Representative McNamer.
Well, we think it was a mistake when the bill was written. We asked for $1.25 million to start out with, and we got $750,000 instead. So they reduced the amount we got. And all we're doing is just ask to match what we got. So we got less than what we had asked for.
Representative McNamer, Representative Leidiger,
so
if I might explain.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Last year when the bill went in, when it came to the committee, it had $1.25 million request to be matched by $1.25 million. The actual bill came out off the House floor in the omnibus budget bill at $750,000 as a grant from the state government, or from DEED, and the match was inadvertently stayed at 1.25. Typically, we write these bills as a 1-to-2 or 2-to-1-to-1 or 1-to-3 match. That's just an oversight on our part, and I didn't even see it last year as we were writing the bill. So we're just going back to our typical way we would write a bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks. I appreciate that explanation. Then can I just ask one general question?
Sure.
Is how is this ethanol plant doing?
Mr. Miller.
Representative, members of the committee, currently, we purchased the facility in 2010, and things are going just fine. We operated through some very, very difficult times in 2012 throughout the drought. Things to be seem to be much more balanced with supply and demand. So as far as the facility itself, the ownership group is a local ownership group with a lot of commitment to keep this facility operating in Morris, Minnesota, and maintain the jobs. This grant and these funds are greatly appreciated as part of an energy and water reduction project so that we can continue to help the facility become more efficient and help the facility become more competitive longer term.
That was my last question, was what the money was going to be used for, and I heard you start to explain it's a water reduction initiative. And is this new technology? Is this new inventions? What exactly are we talking about?
Representative Chairman and members of the committee, the technology that we're looking at today is not would not be considered new technology, but new implementation into the ethanol industry. So there's an opportunity for other ethanol facilities to see the and recognize the improvements that we're looking to make in Morris, and hopefully that can spread throughout other facilities as well.
Representative Liger.
No, I'll end there. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I'm going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion on an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney.
Mr. McNamer, thank you. Mr. Miller. And
thank you.
You didn't even get to introduce yourself.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next bill on the agenda is Representative Rosenthal's House File 2268, my favorite piece of legislation. Welcome to the committee, Representative Rosenthal. I'll let Representative Norton move your bill.
I'd be quite happy to move House File 2268
for re-referral
to taxes.
To taxes. Members, there is an amendment, but before we get started, this is an Economic Development Committee. This is not a tax committee. I'll be pretty clear that your questions, hopefully you'll explain the whole bill, Representative Rosenthal, but the questions that we have should be focused on economic development, not on policy of taxes or not, or other. So, would you like Representative Norton to move the A, I can't get it to move off my fingers, they're so dry, the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, that'd be great.
Does everyone have a copy of the A2 amendment? Is there any comments on the A2 amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, would you like to explain your amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, currently in the fund there's $12 million, and it's, I believe it's run out already this year, and since the bill was enacted in 2010, the money has been gone way before the year end, and this bill simply takes the current threshold of $12 million and moves it to $15 million.
Is there any conversation about any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Passed. We have another amendment here. Do we have copies of this amendment? If you could pass that out. The page.
Yeah.
We have an amendment to pass out here.
Chair, was that the A2 amendment that we,
yep,
that was voted on?
Yeah. From 12 to 15 million.
Can we ask a question on that amendment? I realize we passed it, but
I think right now you would be a good time to ask
we're
that
doing
question.
That.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you. Representative, how many more months are we going to get out of that additional $3 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a good idea, a good question. I don't think there's an answer till we see what the need is. I would hope that it would give us some additional time, and if we need to address it again, I think we should.
Representative Leidinger.
The $12 million you were saying, and I just don't know this, so I'm really trying to kind of figure this out, especially while the paperwork's being handed out. But you're saying that the $12 million, it will run out when? You're on top of this figure?
This current, Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe March 3rd it ran out of money this year. What happens is, Mr. Chair, Representative, is there's a lot of demand for this credit and for businesses that are, say, risky ventures and need this kind of funding to get off the ground and be successful. So what happens is they line up at the very beginning to try and get the request filled immediately. Mm-hmm. And this is an attempt to address that. I'm certainly open to upping the amount if necessary.
Representative Leidinger, if I might.
Please.
Every year this has been in effect. It's gotten shorter and shorter. Just mathematically, you could put almost, I think it's $60 million to get us through 12 months. Frankly, I'm not interested, and I don't think many of us are interested in making wealthier people wealthy by giving them our tax dollars mm-hmm. overly. So maybe there might be a couple people, but not too many. So has everyone got the H22A3 amendment? Okay. And this is I'm going to claim responsibility for this particular one. And what this amendment does is puts a sunset, it changes the sunset. Because right now, the whole program sunsets on the, it actually did sunset, December 31st of 2014. We're going to change it to 2018. And then it will, all the other dates correspond to expand it out another 4 years. I had to be convinced that I shouldn't do just a 2-year extension until I see if the venture capitalist would actually start going somewhere beyond the Golden Crescent of Western Hennepin County. So, is there any conversation about the A3 amendment? Any conversation, any discussion about the A3? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye. 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 All those opposed? Now we have it in the shape that I think the bill can move forward, can be discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill originated in the 2009 Bipartisan Small Business Caucus and was designed and signed into law for the year 2010, and it's due to sunset this year. Originally, it was for $12 million. We wanted to see what the effects would be. It's been very, very successful. There's lots of entrepreneurs in our communities that have really great ideas that need an extra boost. They are not necessarily all going to be successful, but in order for us to help them take the leap, that might provide some great economic activity to the state, which this has already done. I think somewhere in the range of $100 million has been accrued as a result of this funding. So instead of me rambling, I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers in deference to the committee's time, and I know you're all on tight timeline. So I would like to introduce Mr. Jeff Misling. He's the CEO of Inspire. And has used the credit, and I'd like to speak to that.
Misling?
Misling, yes.
Misling.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape. You've got a couple other people behind you that anxiously, so we've got about a half an hour for this bill.
Okay. Yes, my name is Jeff Misling. I'm the founder and CEO of SpineThera, and we are a pharmaceutical company based in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And first of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. I'm here in strong support of the Angel Tax Credit Program. I want to briefly share my personal experience with the program and also my ideas for how it can better benefit the state of Minnesota. When an entrepreneur decides to quit a job and start a company, they're taking a huge leap of faith. I had to have a conversation with my wife to quit a very solid job at a company in Eden Prairie called Sermotix and say, let's pursue this dream. And everyone has to cross what entrepreneurs call the valley of death, which is how do you go from having an idea, this wonderful idea to create life-saving technology, to actually having a product available. In the very beginning, when you have only an idea and no money, who's going to be the first person to give you some money to get this launched? The classic is friends, family, and founder. The angel capital networks in town, there's groups like Minnesota Angels, Gopher Angels, even they won't touch you when you're just simply an idea. They want to see something tangible. Using the Angel Tax Credit Program, I was able to raise $480,000 for my pharmaceutical company, a company that's going to need to raise $25 million in total before we have a product that we can sell off into a larger pharmaceutical company or in the market. So you can see how risky it would be to put the first $500,000 into a venture that's going to need eventually $25 million. The Angel Tax Credit Program, in my case, brought in $320,000 from the state of Wisconsin. So this is money that flowed into the state. Of course, those investors received the tax credit, and we're very grateful to have it. But I think that's one aspect of the program that needs to be also understood, is it's attracting capital from outside Minnesota into Minnesota companies. It keeps us competitive with the surrounding states. And one thing you need to know about angel investors is they are very biased to invest locally. Most angel investors will only look at a company that's within 50 miles of where they are. So if you're talking to somebody, you know, that lives in Milwaukee or San Francisco or Boston, they by default don't want to hear from you. But when you mention that the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit Program can return 25% of their investment immediately or within the next year, they don't hang up on you and they'll listen. And I was able to raise $320,000 from Wisconsin. So the program is great. I'm convinced it's created jobs. I think the folks from Deed here can attest to that with real numbers. It's created jobs already. It's already gained a return on investment. I know their survey showed that 30% of the money, 30% of the investors said they wouldn't have put their money in without the credit. So that's an immediate return on investment. But there's two problems that I could see for the state to address. First, the program is running out of money faster and faster. In 2011, it ran out in November. The next year, it ran out in July. Then it ran out in May. And this year, it ran out on March 3rd. If that trend continues, next year, it'll run out in 1 week or as fast as Mr. Nelson's office at Deed can process the applications, which is a very efficient operation. But there is pent-up demand for this. And what it's actually done is created an investment season in Minnesota where everyone is lining up to take advantage of the credit and make their investment. That is disruptive to the flow of a startup company. And literally, I'm sitting here today, I have $710,000 of investments on the table with the investors saying, if there's angel tax credit money, we will write you the checks. But if there's not, well, we'll see. You know, they haven't told me firmly no, but that's what it gets down to for the individual companies, is that it really gets investors to move and make a decision to invest. And I would actually advocate that we increase the funding to $20 to $25 million a year. If you believe that it creates jobs and you believe there's a return on investment, that's more money coming into the state and more jobs created. The second issue, which I think has been addressed already, is it needs to be extended into the future. So I'm happy to see the amendment passed today. I won't take up any more time, but would be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr.
Misling, yes.
Misling. Seeing Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Misling, I think that your testimony was spot on in terms of this program. I know this program has been successful in other states around the country. It's a great incubator for startup businesses. Like you say, nobody's going to borrow you the money. I can imagine, and my question to you is, I imagine you talked to banks, and what was their reaction to your idea?
Well, actually, my father was a banker. He's retired. So he told me before, don't even waste your time going to a bank. Mm-hmm. Right? So he, you know, just having that relationship with my father, he he steered me away from a bank. I mean, you have no collateral. You have nothing. I mean, you need money to file a patent application, right? I mean, that's going to cost $15,000 to file a halfway decent patent application. Where, you know, so you have to dip into your personal savings, and you need those people to take that leap of faith that they believe in you as an entrepreneur, they believe in the idea that you're pursuing, and they're going to write you that first check. But a bank is just out of the question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you. That's exactly my point. And I think that this is a very, very good program. We're probably not putting enough money into this from a jobs perspective, just like you say. And I'm happy to support this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Missling, thank you so very much. Appreciate it. Did you have a? It looks like you've got a couple others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I believe the Commissioner of Deed is here, and we'd like to hear what she has to say.
The Commissioner wants to come up and talk to me about angel investment after the last time?
That's right.
She's a brave woman. Commissioner, how nice to see you again. I think it was last time or the time before that. So, please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Katie Clark-Sieben, the Commissioner of Deed. I'm delighted to be back today talking about what we think is a very important program for the state's economic development program. The governor has recommended $15 million per year in funding for the Angel Tax Credit Program. The legislature passed and Deed launched the Angel Tax Credit Program in July of 2010 to encourage private investments in technology startups, high technology startups in the state, particularly software, medical device, and biotechnology firms. And there is a reason why this program is aimed at high technology, because we believe that these industries help produce some of the higher wages that we will see in the state. You just heard an excellent testimony, and I'd like to just provide a reminder of what the goal of this program is and what it's aimed at accomplishing. This program is about is our one state economic development tool to fund companies at this point in the business life cycle. So as you heard, these are companies that typically have one to two employees. They often have an idea, a concept, the beginnings of a product, but haven't yet taken that product to market, and they're in that product development stage. Often the fundraising that they are receiving is through family and friends and networks, their personal networks, because at that level of, in this stage of the business life cycle, there are very few investors who will take a look at this high risk of a project. This program is about investing in entrepreneurs in innovation in our state so that we're growing the next 3M or Medtronic. Not every single one of the angel companies that we're funding is going to be successful with their product, but we believe by supporting entrepreneurs and innovators in our state that eventually we will see greater job growth. What we have seen so far, according to the study conducted by Economic Development Research, that this program supported an average of 512 jobs at Minnesota startup firms from 2010 to 2012, and that number is expected to climb to an average of 635 jobs from 2013 to 2020. And I just want to remind you, we've spent a lot of time recently talking about the Minnesota Investment Fund, the Minnesota Job Creation Fund, where we see hundreds of new jobs, thousands of new jobs. This is a very different program specifically for the small startup with one to two employees. So these job creation numbers are significant job creation numbers for this size of business in the state. In addition, I think it's important to also highlight that 571 indirect jobs were created in 2013 through this program. And I think the key to this program is that this is driving new investment into the state of Minnesota that we would not have seen otherwise. This is attracting investors from Minnesota. This is attracting investors from other states and outside of our country to take a look at entrepreneurs and innovators here in the state and invest in their businesses. And one thing that we know is that entrepreneurs like to surround themselves with entrepreneurs because they can all leverage the networks that they each have. They know how to surround themselves with others that are doing product development. As these companies grow, we are going to see additional growth happen in greater Minnesota, and we're already seeing that. From the annual report, which will be released this afternoon, I believe there are 34 companies that have already expanded to locations in greater Minnesota to further develop their product. So this program was started in 2010. It's still very beginning stages of this program, but a very important one that I hope we have your support on.
So before we go any farther, I'm the next one on the list. Mr. Albright comes next. Commissioner, I know this. You know this question's coming, so I hope you've prepared. Can you tell me how many of those 512 direct jobs and 500 and some odd other ones are outside of the Golden Crescent of Eden Prairie to Maple Grove?
Mr. Chair and members, there are very few, but what we do know is that the companies that have already experienced this program, so it just started in 2010, where we were investing in companies of 1 to 2 employees. Growth doesn't usually just happen overnight. It typically takes some time to add jobs to a business. We know that around 34 of those businesses have already started expanding their operations in greater Minnesota as they look for additional square footage needs and other resources to grow their business. So we do think that as this program continues over time, we will see additional economic development in greater Minnesota from this program.
And Commissioner, it's really too bad that those jobs aren't growing anyplace other than that Golden Triangle and greater Minnesota, because all the rest of the metro area. And Commissioner, I'm using you as a foil, and that's really somewhat inappropriate. I mean, I'm really speaking to the venture capital community. There was an implicit promise from the venture capital community 4 years ago when I sat in a room and had discussions about this particular bill, that they would actually get outside of the metro area. They would actually look at statewide. And they have not lived up to their promise at all. So it's really frustrating to me. Mm-hmm. As one of the people who blood, sweat, and teared this bill through. So to the venture capital world, I really wanted this to be a 2-year extension of this bill at this particular time, and I will fight until we pass the bill to get a 2-year extension to see what the venture capital world does. Because they didn't listen the first time. I'm wondering if they just got earwax. So I will leave it at that, Commissioner. And did you want to respond to that, Representative Rosenthal?
At the risk of...
Good idea.
No.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to throw the Commissioner a lifeline here. Because in the testimony of Mr. Missling, he came from a company by the name of Surmodics, who I'm very familiar with, who uses liquid fluid retention for preparation of test modules for a whole host of organizations. But the genesis for that organization actually came out of another one of our long-standing organizations named Medtronic. Mm-hmm. The CEO that was at Surmodics came from Medtronic. So the legacy that is our research and development community hovers around a supporting cast of characters, if you will, which also, from habits, you know, and we're all creatures of habit, comes from where is the research base, and in this case, it's the University of Minnesota. It's folks that are in similar environments, whether it be in biotechnology, the high tech, or existing organizations. And so this golden crescent that you speak of is not something, unfortunately, that can be forced into other areas of the state for similar purposes, although I think every purpose, as we're familiar with Representative Gunther's area with AGCO down there, from a standpoint of what's happening down there, that could very likely spawn as we move in terms of technological advances in the agricultural area. You might find that as being a hotbed, a new golden crescent down there. You might find it up on, dare I say, the range for other purposes, either technological advancements or otherwise. But more to the point in terms of what my question is for the commissioner. You mentioned in your testimony that, and as Mr. Misling did as well, is that you're attracting investment capital from outside of the state. Do you have a list of who that is, and you're tracking it, and for what purposes from an exit interview? What type of information are you collecting, and for what reasons and purposes do they find this mechanism so attractive? And if they do, are there recommendations that they might attribute to it that would make it better?
Mr. Chair and members, we do have that information, and I would like to call, if appropriate, Mr. Chair, Jeff Nelson, who is our Angel Tax Credit Coordinator, to share further detail with you. I would like to take a moment to just highlight the fantastic work that Jeff does. We hear from businesses regularly how efficiently run this program is and how they're often surprised at how quickly they receive a response.
You hadn't, I was. Mr. Nelson, please identify yourself for the tape and answer the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Nelson. I run the Angel Tax Credit Program for Deed. The program has been in operation since 2010, as the commissioner has mentioned, and the statistics have been fairly consistent. About a quarter to 30% of both the number of investors and the investment dollars have come from outside of Minnesota. Minnesota's program is relatively unique. As Mr. Misling was stating to the committee, the tax credit program that we run is a refundable tax credit, meaning the investors need not have any Minnesota tax liability in order to take advantage of the program. I think that's that is a huge factor in why we've been able to attract so many investors and so many dollars from outside of Minnesota.
Does that give you your answer?
I have another one.
Okay, go right ahead, Representative Albright.
To that extent,
we're going to be done with this and vote on it in 10 minutes, and I got two more testifiers.
Not a problem. To the extent that we see, you know, the arteries going out into the state via our transportation system, whether it be 169 or 94 or 35 going up to Duluth, do you find any mention of along those corridors or commerce as a comment made by these people as far as they're aligning with other like-minded organizations outside of that Golden Crescent to, you know, reflect upon the chair's concerns about the concentration in the western suburbs?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you won't be surprised that in the legislative report that will be coming out later today, we do have a map in that report, and you won't be surprised that there's sort of a corridor going from St. Cloud to the metro area down to Rochester. That's where the primary investment is.
Thank you.
And Representative Albright, and to the members, I was pleasantly surprised. And Commissioner and Mr. Nelson, if you could step aside, I know there's two other people looking to testify, and we'll get them up there. Just to the venture capital community, I met a person at one of our receptions that we don't have to pay for, I guess, and you know everybody's upset about, that was talking about they had just done 11 investments. And because that person took 6 months to do their homework, they found 9 of them outside of the metro area, and only 2 of them unfortunately in the Golden Crescent. I'm going to really use that, and everybody will be talking about the Golden Crescent. So that was a lesson that if investors do their homework, there are other places in this state to invest. Who would like to go first?
I will, Mr. Chair. Genevieve Plumador with Life Science Alley. We've been before this committee before. Life Science Alley represents all of the medical device companies, biotechnology companies, and biopharma companies here in the state. We have the big ones, the Medtronics and the 3Ms, and then we also have the early stage development companies the testifier that I brought here today. Life Science Alley just asks for your continued support of this tax credit. It is has been very important in the last year to leverage dollars and investments into Minnesota, as was evidenced in the Department of Revenue tax report, as well as the report that Life Science Alley came out with at the end of last year. Where the rest of the country is seeing less investment, we're seeing greater investment in these early stage development companies. CEOs such as the testifier here today are finding that larger VCs are not wanting to invest during the precarious time, as the prior testifier had said. So I'd like to just cede my time to Pramod Hosharin. He's from Nerva Medical, who is going to tell you about his angel success story, and he's currently in the first year of R&D development of his product.
And before he starts, I'd like to throw a comment about your boss, Dale, Mr. Wallstrom.
Yep.
He was very instrumental in getting this passed the first time, and everyone should be very grateful to Dale and Life Science Alley that likes this program. So, with you.
Good afternoon, sir, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Life Science Alley, is also inviting me to share my passion with you. My name is Pramod Hojalan,
Genevieve,
I'm sorry. mentioned that I started a company to build a catheter like this that would actually save the heart. So in short, because we don't have a lot of time, so our technology would cool the heart down to prevent the dead tissue of the heart muscle after heart attack, which actually as a result of using stent. So it is very important technology, and actually the current technology in the market, we already have cooling technology in the market, but those technology are actually for brain protection in the case of the heart stop, which is very different from what we do. When they're trying to apply to the heart attack patients, those technology are too slow. So we actually developed this technology, and actually there's a big cooling system. I mean, not big, but another cooling system outside. I could not bring it here. We actually did the animal study last year in December, and we found that we were actually amazed by that too. In our first study, we can cool the heart down within 2 minutes. To give you the perspective, the standard, the fastest cooling technology in the market right now take an hour to cool. So we actually more than 30 times faster than the current technology. And I probably don't need to say that angel tax credit is a big part of this, because when I raise money, this is done after I have first funding, right, to do this. But when we don't have the money, we don't have this yet, we only have the idea, it was the angel tax that actually helped us, convince the investor who believe in technology but have some hesitant because of the risk of that state. So I don't need to echo the point that Mr. Missling has been said, and actually my case is actually the same. 80% of the money that I raised actually come out from out of states, from Pennsylvania actually, but obviously more than 90% of my spending is in Minnesota, so we are actually attracting this. And heart attack is a big problem in the world, not just in the United States. We estimate that the market size is to be more than $1 billion only in U.S. alone. The point here is that will create a lot of job in the future, because obviously for $1 billion I cannot do it myself. But the other point that I want to add is that I used to work for Boston Scientific. That's how I got some experience to do this. And even we raised the first money, we don't have a lot of money. I'm very fortunate to have a lot of people, a lot of network that helped me both on the technical and the business advice and assistance. So we built this technology actually in my basement. So this is a real garage startup, just like Earl Buchan started Medtronics many, many years ago. And I hope to repeat that history again. Because we are here in the metro area where we have a very diverse background, it's really helped us. And I also got a lot of help from University of Minnesota as well. Dr. Paul Isio provide both advice and you know, some other assistance for me. So that is very, very important that I want to share. In the early state, like what where we are right now, we need various type of skill. So it's not one specific. It's not just engineering. We need a lot of things. So it would be very difficult for me if I said that, live in the loop or something. One thing I want, before I end my talk, I want to say that last year I had some privilege to be invited to present my my projects with Dr. Fogarty. I don't know if anybody knows Dr. Fogarty. He's in Bay Area in California. He's almost 80 now. When he in the 60s, he invented the first catheter to remove clot from the artery without surgery. Well, I was very intimidated. I am not, before my life before Novamed, I was just a scientist. I don't know anything about the business, so I learned everything from actually a lot of people around me. So I was very nervous to present to the idol of the medical device industry of the world, and to go to the Bay Area, which is, you know that. So I was very, very nervous. So, but when I presented that, I have to say that my mentor here, Dale is one of them, prepared me so well that I can answer all the questions. I made a very good impressions, you know, to the team there, even being just one guy starting the company in my basement. So we have a lot of things here that I want to say. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Representative Ward. Well, thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate it, and I have had a couple of conversations with you, and I've been wanting to catch up with you, so good. Thank Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr.
Pramod.
Pramod?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Pramod, can you tell me, I thought I heard you say that you started out of your basement, just on your own?
It is still in the basement right now, yes, sir.
It is still in the basement?
Yes, sir, but I have very fortunate, like, you know, I have my friend who are electrical engineers that built the system for us. Actually, the system was built by the University of Minnesota on that design, senior design project, and then my friend continued to work after the student was done with that semester.
Okay,
Representative Ward.
So I wanted to get to the to a question about, and did you say it would be difficult for you to move up to Duluth?
Well, I would say so, because like here,
probably,
you know,
not Brainerd.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't mean particularly the loop. Maybe I shouldn't mention the city in particular.
I just want to, you know, verify what you said, and you're welcome in Brainerd anytime. But so because of the technology, because of the knowledge and base here, and those type of things, that's what you're saying as you're developing this company, correct?
Correct.
So tell me what you project as job growth within your company because of the Angel X.
Well, I have to say that, like, to answer your questions, like, you know, for startup, number one, we have to be lean. So we're not going to, like, even though we have needs to have a lot of people to do this project, this is not a small project. We would need hundreds of people to do this, but we can't hire hundreds of people. So before I can give you the number, my point here is that there's two sides of that. One is that we're going to grow our company organically. So that would probably going to be between 30 to 50 people that I see, you know, we're going to grow into the team before we would be acquired, or, well, who knows, we might go to an IPO, become independent company. Realistically, you know, I think the economic impact that we're going to make is actually by outsourcing our work to the local company. And, you know, like, for example, last year I went to a clinical conference, and there's vendors that come from Pennsylvania about, like, you know, clinical study. In my mind, I was thinking, why do I want to talk to, I mean, she's good, but we have great people that are doing clinical study. Why do I want to talk to someone in Pennsylvania?
You don't.
So that's my point. I want to say that, like, the economic impact that we will create is not only how we grow our company organically, it's also the work that we have to send out.
So, Mr. Chair, final
there's an award.
Thank you. So you expect to see some significant growth within
definitely
our market in here. And again, on a personal note, did you say your device takes the place of a stent? I'm really interested in that right now.
Definitely. I'll try to be concise on that. Okay, well, when you have heart attack, when, not you, when someone have heart attack. I'm sorry, that's always the bad thing. When someone have heart attack, the first thing that the doctor want to do is open the blocked artery by stent, which is intuitive. You get the flow back to the tissue that's dying. But what people don't know, even in medical communities, don't talk about that, is that the flow that coming back to the tissue actually start attacking the cells, induce another set of informations. So it's like, and we know about this, and the scientists know about this like long time ago, before I was born actually. But what are you going to do? Because if you don't open the blocked artery, it will die anyway. So the cooling help by prevent that. So we are not replacing stent. We actually make stent work better.
Mm. Thank you for that information. Will you make an appointment with my LA?
I want to add that, like, we are talking about 80% reductions of the tissue death, you know, compared to using stent alone.
And that's very huge.
Mr. Chair.
Whitney Hope, I see no other questions at the moment, and we're going to try and get on to Representative Norton's bill. But I will say, you know, your technology is very exciting. There's not heart issues in my family, but I do know a lot of people that have that particular issue. Yes, no one said I had a heart, but and your technology. And I've met, I mean, members. I had breakfast with Mr. Pamor. Yeah,
definitely.
I think there was 8 or 12 other entrepreneurs. This is a fabulous program. It just cannot be, you know, I'm beating a dead horse. It's a great program. We do need to fund it. It does create a lot of jobs. And most businesses take, after they're actually a business, because yours is not really a business just yet. Yours is a startup. It takes 5 to 7 years. So this, if we're going, before they really start ramping up on employees. More people know that. So this does have to be given a chance to actually follow through. I hope it spreads itself out. Representative Rosenthal, do you have any closing comments before we make the motion to refer to taxes?
Mr. Chair, I don't think I could do it any better than my testifiers.
Smart man. Brief. Brevity. Brevity is always good. So, members, all those in favor of re-referring House File 2268 as amended to taxes, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, you're on your way to taxes. I hope there's a few changes in taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next on the agenda is House File 2633, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Could I move House File 2633 to be re-referred to taxes, please?
Yes, you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to move very quickly here because my testifier is needed upstairs in just a few moments, and I would like him to testify before he leaves. So I'm just going to kind of give a brief overview. You heard the Angel Investment Tax Credit Bill just a moment ago. This is very similar to that, and it has several exceptions. So what we're trying to do is have $5 million be directed specifically to Greater Minnesota. As you saw, and you'll see a handout in just a moment, Greater Minnesota was not one of the winners in the Angel Investment Tax Credit Program, and we would like it to be a winner along with the, what was it called, the Golden Crescent.
He is starting.
It is. I'll start spreading that. The Greater Minnesota Caucus has met, and this is on their list of priorities as well, and I wanted you to know that before we get started. The three major differences in the bill that you just heard and the bill before you right now is that it is targeted to rural Minnesota. The credit rate is 50% rather than 25%. It includes agricultural processing and manufacturing businesses, which have been exempted from the angel investment bill that you just heard. That was focused more on high tech and innovation. and high tech and innovation is desired out in rural Minnesota as well, but that opportunity still lies within that the other bill as in addition to this. And then the other change you need to know about is the mandatory minimum wage is set at the average hourly wage in Greater Minnesota rather than using the Twin Cities number, and that's been an issue for many folks as they've struggled with how to use this particular program. So I'm just going to stop there and let my testifier go so that he can get upstairs, and then we can get back to questions when we're done.
Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Representative Norton, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Randy Kerr, Executive Director of the Albert Lee Freeborn County Chamber of Commerce and a member of the Greater Minnesota Partnership Board of Directors. And while we are very appreciative of the Angel Investment Tax Program that exists today, you will see by this handout that, as Representative Norton said, we have not been winners, and as the Chair has pointed out, from our standpoint, we have a tremendous focus in Albert Lee, and we just lost about 15 members of the Albert Lee community who were here and headed off to that meeting upstairs. But one of the focuses of our community is entrepreneurship, but because of the wage requirements, because of the high-tech requirements in the existing legislation, we are not able to take advantage in Greater Minnesota of to the extent that we really should be able to. As pointed out in another committee, we are suffering somewhat on the broadband scheme of things. So the high-tech businesses are not attracted to our communities, and the wage requirements are a major restriction. Would ask you to consider this legislation as a way to level the playing field between the Golden Crescent and Greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Former Representative Dorman, did you have a couple of comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, absolutely. Dan Dorman, Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership, an organization interested in economic development issues in Greater Minnesota. And prior to taking this job, Mr. Chair and members, the last 6 years, I was the EDA Director in the City of Albert Lee, and can tell you firsthand that the state in general has a problem attracting enough venture capital, but as bad as it is statewide, it's terrible in Greater Minnesota, and we thank Representative Norton for her leadership on this bill in order to try to reinvigorate the economy in Greater Minnesota. The same thing is happening in the metropolitan area. One thing that we talk a lot about and that should be a concern not just to Greater Minnesota folks but also Metro folks, Moody's, one of the state's rating agencies in their bond rating in their October report to the state, highlighted their concern that there's a growing divergence between the metropolitan and non-metropolitan economy. If this continues and we don't reverse that, that's going to be a problem not just in Greater Minnesota but Minnesota in general. We think that Representative Norton's bill would be a great first step to help correct that.
Thank you, Mr.
That's Clark. As brief as I can be, sir.
There you go. Mr. Flaherty, did you have a few comments you'd like to... Mr. Chair, we'll open it up for questions.
My name is Tim Flaherty, and I'm here representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is 85 cities outside the metro area. And my comments can't be as brief as Dan's, but they'll try to be brief.
It's the first time I've ever been briefer than somebody, I think. That's something.
We first, as an organization, first proposed an angel investment tax credit back in 2002. So I want you all have a little history of this. That was before the state had any angel investment tax credit, and that was because we noticed, and all the research was showing, that over 95% of the angel investment money was flowing to the Twin Cities and not to Greater Minnesota. So we thought maybe some kind of an incentive would help draw some private investment to start up companies in Greater Minnesota. So that was in 2002. In 2003, it was actually included, a provision just for Greater Minnesota was included in the House Omnibus Tax Bill, but unfortunately not in the Senate. In 2004, actually, the Senate passed it and included it in their Omnibus Tax Bill, but the House didn't, so we couldn't quite get agreement between the House and the Senate over those 2 years. And in 2005, Governor Plenty proposed an angel investment tax credit for Greater Minnesota, Unfortunately, he limited to just the Job Z zones. So what happened that year, it was passed in the House, like the governor had proposed it. In the Senate, they also passed a provision, but it wasn't limited to Job Z. So there was no agreement, so it didn't come out of the conference committee. So I'm just saying, and then we dropped it for a few years, and then in 2009, of course, you passed what you did, which we think, you know, we agree with the concept. We think the concept is good. We've looked at other states. They have programs that to attract private investment into startup businesses, and we think that's a good thing to do. So we're happy that the program that you have works in primarily in the metro area. In 2010, we started to look at this issue, and really what we thought, well, just increase the credit in greater Minnesota. That'll maybe attract some private investment out there. And then actually I went out and talked to some of the professionals and businesses out there, and I got educated a bit. First thing that came up in Winona was they didn't think they'd ever use the program because the high wage requirement. And all we're asking for is that the wage requirement be set at the average in greater Minnesota, not the average in the Twin Cities. But, you know, there are these barriers that are kind of built into the current program.
Mr. Flaherty, if I might interrupt you, it's not the average wage in the Twin Cities in the original bill.
Yeah.
It is not, and I would appreciate it if you would not call it that.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Would you agree that that it ends up being about the average? I mean, that's not the technical way that it's described, but it ends up being very close to that.
It is set at 1.5% of the poverty rate for a family of four. $18.50 an hour.
Ooh, okay. But that ends up being a fairly high rate.
I'm just saying, if you're looking for the support of the chairman, you might want to rephrase
I'll rephrase that. It's set on percent of poverty level, I think. Is that what you're saying? And it ends up, as it spells out, it's about $19-$20 per hour. And in greater Minnesota, the average is quite a bit less than that. So, I mean, what I was hearing from the businesses was they were saying that $13 an hour for these startup things they could live with. Okay, Kim is telling me to wrap it up here. The other companies...
We have to go to taxes.
Okay, the other companies we talked to also raised some of these barriers, which I think are addressed in her bill. And we think the program will work. We want a chance to try it and see if it will work if we modify it for our communities.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just to add a little bit on the wage criteria. You are correct. It is, but it brings 175% of the wage requirement for a family of four. But regardless, it is the same wage statewide, and that does present us some problems. I did speak with somebody, and they were a little bit shy to come testify today, but they're working on a startup that would actually meet every requirement in the bill except for the wage requirement. He's saying, I can't start this company and bring people in at $20 an hour. I think it's $20.03 is what he calculated at. I think it's $19.70, but it's close. And that is one of the problems that we have in greater Minnesota, is that there is that wage difference. And so we think there needs to be two tiers.
Seeing no questions, how about Mr. Fabian? Representative Fabian, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the questions about, to the point of the average hourly wage in greater Minnesota, I heard $13. I'm not exactly sure. Can you quantify that for me? What is the number?
We, let's see, I think I might be able to find it here quickly. The average overall wage outside the seven county metro area, the numbers we got from Deed, now this was a year ago, was $15.33 per hour. And in the Twin Cities, using that same scale, it was $19.60 per hour. So.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dorman, you said something about venture capital in Minnesota. Can you elaborate on why venture capital is so scarce in Minnesota, please?
Which one would like to catch that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I think there are a variety of reasons. Minnesota lags behind a lot of states, and a lot of states lag behind a few. There's more venture capital in states like California, New York, and other areas for a variety of reasons. Minnesota doesn't seem to attract it. There's something happening more than just the business climate, which gets talked about a lot. I don't believe that it's just that, because there are some other states that have a similar climate that seem to attract venture capital. So I don't know that the reports that I've read, the things that I've read, I've never been convinced that there's one reason to point at it and say, here's why this capital tends to flow there. All I can tell you is it isn't flowing to Minnesota in general like we would like it to, and it sure isn't flowing to greater Minnesota like we'd want it to.
And Representative Mahoney, Chair Mahoney, I would just like to say this has been an issue when I was on your vice chair in bioscience a number of years ago and served on jobs with you. The VC issue we've talked about at length, and actually we had started, I thought, some pretty significant efforts even in southern Minnesota to interest venture capitalists to come to Minnesota, and it was just prior to the recession hitting, we had several large firms interested in perhaps growing here, and that all stopped. And so I think we're kind of starting over and fresh now, and I think it's an issue not just for the rural angel investment, but the whole, everything Deed is working on right now in many of the areas and the larger bill as well. So I think we have a challenge ahead of us, and I don't think there's an easy answer, but I'm willing to work on it if you are.
And members, we have four people, and 12 minutes. So, Representative Ugham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I'll be brief. I just have one question. The credit rate on this bill is 50% versus 25%. Simple question. Why?
I think, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think we're just, it's a challenge, as we've seen from, I don't know if your little charts are colored and if it's easy to see that breakdown. We have a challenge in greater Minnesota, and it's just another carrot to try to get those investments out in rural Minnesota. We certainly would be willing to look in the future at making a change there if we can jumpstart this. I will also mention, I've been working with the chair. He's not interested in leaving money on the table. And so as this goes to taxes, we will look at saying if in a time certain we're not finding that this program is luring the investors, the angel investors, into rural Minnesota, that money would then roll over into the larger fund. I don't know. We haven't quite yet set a time or date. We really hoped we would have the first full year to get this going, because there's an education component, and it's going to be new. We're adding some parts to it, too. So I know we're willing to talk about that, and the chair is going to make us talk about it, I think, as we move ahead. So
very good. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the author, you know, in light of what Mr. Dorman said about concern about the wage issue and the pressure on wages in greater Minnesota, I'm looking at line 2.34 with regard to agricultural processing, and I'm just curious, in light of what would be the norm for the average wage in an agricultural processing plant, I'm just wondering how that squares with the construct in this bill for a minimum wage, as it were.
I don't have an answer for that, and I think Deed is the one that would work through some of these, the details of how that goes out, but I hear Representative Dorman. What do we call him?
Representative Albright. Mr. Dorman. It's possible, you know, I think what you're driving at is would an average food processor be able to use that, depending on where you set the wage level, and the answer might be no, and if that's okay. I mean, if we set this at, let's arbitrarily use $15 for a moment, and somebody wants to pay $12.50, God bless them, go do it. Just don't use this program. This program is designed to help startups that would pay wages above average. So, I mean, I think our problem isn't that there's a strong threshold in there. It's just that threshold is different. If you set one threshold in the state, just by the nature of the economy, it disadvantages Greater Minnesota. We're saying create an incentive for a like-paying job, so if it's whatever that processor is, whatever that job function is, create the same incentive so you can incentivize it in the metropolitan area or Greater Minnesota. But if somebody, to your point, someone has to pay $12 an hour, I don't think we want to use this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I'm next on it, and a couple people have taken some of the questions that I had. I will say that in some parts of Minnesota, I just heard a bill the other day in another committee that you can't get the workers to show up to be there because the housing isn't there. So if what you're trying to do is incentivize development in certain parts of Greater Minnesota, you're trying to focus this bill, I think you might have missed a little piece of that right there, because you can start up all the companies you want, but if you can't house people in luxury apartments, as someone called them,
fish house,
how do you start the business? So,
Mr. Chair, could I respond to that?
Sure.
I would say, just as we had our angel investor CEO here a few moments ago, these startups start very small, and in fact, they have to be less than, I believe, 10. Is that correct? It's the same as the angel investment. It's small, so it generally starts with one or two and grows. But to your point, if we hope to have the big boys out there, we will have housing and other issues to contend with. But the big girls. But right now, this is for very small businesses, and I think it wouldn't tax our communities at the early startup stage.
So
we have time, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton, thank you for that answer. One of my concerns here is the way this is set up is that in St. Cloud is being considered as the same as Worthington, and they are entirely different areas. Duluth is being considered the same. Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud are all being lumped into the same, where they get that lower wage, where I would be kind of wondering about what the wage would be and the average wage in those towns are. But I suspect it's probably a little bit higher in Rochester and could easily be larger in Duluth or in St. Cloud. So I think you've got a concern there. I, for me, with this bill, I'd like to see a little bit clearer understanding of the agricultural processing, because I could certainly see agricultural processing moving into the ethanol and the chemical replacement, biochemical replacement industry. And that is, we need a little bit clearer definition of that. I'm also wondering, I know you took the angel investment bill that's been in place for a while. If we're bumping up the dollar figure the percentage from 25 to 50, have you looked at the $4 million cap? And do you need the $4 million cap? It's a question I have. I don't need an answer right now. That's actually a tax question. But I'm just giving you some ideas that you're going to have some other questions about this particular piece.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair.
I have some concerns about this that really go towards the tax end of it. And as I said, with the where it lands and who gets to take advantage of this. I will talk with the author and the tax committee a little bit, and hopefully they will deal with them there. Representative Fabian, you had a question? Or were you going to just respond to luxury apartments?
Mr. Chair, you're very insightful. Thank you. You know, it's
It's interesting, you know, we talk about economic development and so forth, and the bill that Chair Mahoney was talking about, I think it's probably the one that I had, because it mentioned luxury apartments in Roseau, and we don't do that. We build luxury deer stands and fish houses, but, you know, yeah, we ship them over to Representative Metza, but it's interesting we have this discussion about, you know, the average hourly wage in Greater Minnesota, and we talk about housing and so forth, and then we try to empower local officials to do something at absolutely zero expense to the state of Minnesota. And in this case, and I support these angel investment credits, now we're asking the taxpayers to dig into their wallets and help these businesses out, which I'm okay with. But when we ask for a TIF district, our local officials to create a TIF district so that they can put a tool in their drawer, we get all kinds of pushback. And I'm kind of new around here, and I don't quite understand why that is. And the major employers in my area pay a substantially more starting wage than the average in Greater Minnesota. I'm just confused by all that. And someday I'd love to have a Diet Coke with you, Mr. Chair, so we could maybe I could get more insight. Thank you.
Maybe
I'm lobbying on my behalf. You realize that?
I understood, but it'd have to be throwback Pepsi before we sit down. I don't do diet.
I'll see if I can get Jeff Gordon to give you a ride.
just to answer, unless you wanted to go there, I can certainly take Representative Faber
well,
answer.
Chair Mahoney, I think that's really a tax. It's not relevant to this bill in front of us. It's really a larger tax question, and so I'd really not rather get into that, and it's not my expertise either.
And members, one of the things that we had extensive hearings in another committee about venture capital, and venture capitalists of this world have. They're doing what the big banks on Wall Street did. They're privatizing the risk and socializing the. Privatizing the profit and socializing the risk. And unfortunately, if we want to move many things forward in this world, we get caught between trying or not trying and socializing risk. And unfortunately, they're typically the business owners and people with a lot of money. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, Rep. Norton, why did you drop the proprietary technologies part of the original bill?
Representative Norton.
Thank you.
Representative Kiefer, Mr. Chair, because that opportunity is still going to be available in the other angel investment tax credit, we're not doing this instead of, we're doing it in addition to, and we think what we've put in here instead will be more appropriate for rural Minnesota. And if people do want to do the other, it's still available at the 25% credit rating on the larger bill that you just heard a moment ago. I don't know if you were in here, but those are all things we could talk about. And my guess is at the end of the day, Representative Kiefer, these bills are going to be melded together. What we're trying to do with this bill is address this problem, which is rural Minnesota is being left out of opportunities. We want to be a part of them, and so we're trying to make that happen. And we're very flexible to making changes as we need in taxes or here if you had them, but no one brought an amendment forward, so I think we'll do it in taxes.
See? Oh, Representative Albright, did you have a question?
Oh, well, I'll just...
Did you have a further...
You know, yeah, just a little bit on that. I know. It's just that when the original angel credit came about, it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I like it. But my concern was it was just so narrow, and I wanted to see it expand to lots of other things. And so I think this is a step in the right direction, but I still think it's just kind of picking and choosing winners and trying to micromanage job growth in certain areas. And I would just like to see more and more opportunities for everybody across the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you have ideas, Representative Kiefer, bring them forward.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Baby, did you have a question? Not Baby, I'm sorry. Albright, did you have a question?
No, sir.
Okay. Seeing no further question. Representative Norton, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, Mr. Chair. Renew the motion that House File 2633 be referred to taxes.
All those in favor of the stated motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. You're on your way to taxes.
Thank you very much.
Representative McNamer, I think you have one more bill up.
Wow.
Here's John. Is he coming? Huh? Representative McNamer, I'd like to. I think this would likely stay in the committee. So we're very likely to just lay this bill over and keep it an omnibus bill. So I have more work to do on the floor and more opportunities for people to pick on me on the floor. The staffer is over there laughing. So I will move House File 2262 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. You have an A1 amendment. So, and it's a delete everything amendment. So, I will move the A1 amendment to get it before the committee. I would ask that you explain your amendment. It's a building code issue. Go for it, and then we'll vote on your amendment.
Chair Mahoney, members, I'm Representative Jay McNamer, District 12A again. And thanks for accepting our moving for the A1 amendment. That puts the bill in the form I'd like it to be in. I'm happy to say the A1 amendment is a compromise between the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, and the Department of Labor and Industry. I have with me today Patrick Hines from the League of Minnesota Cities, Mike Jacobson from local building inspector from Morrison Benson, and John Bukowski from Department of Labor and Industry. I'd like to give a little history on how this bill came about. The City of Morris contacted me, or my office, and asked me to support a bill that the League and the Association of Minnesota Building Officials was working on. This bill changes the way that the Department of Labor and Industry delegates authority to the local building officials to inspect hospitals, nursing homes, and public buildings. I heard from Benson and other communities that they were concerned that their certified building officials were having difficulty getting approval from the Department of Labor and Industry to inspect these buildings in the past. And Chair Mahoney, I think I talked to you about this in January. The Association of Minnesota Building Officials and the League thought the current process could be made more clear, and they wanted to have more information about what standards they needed to meet in order to have authority to inspect hospitals, nursing homes, and other public buildings. I told the League of Minnesota Cities that I would author the bill, but I wanted them to work with the Department of Labor and Industries and come up with a compromise. I'm pleased that both sides, or all sides, work together, and this bill is the compromise. With this, what this bill does is this. There's four things. Number one, it gives local building officials a better idea of what they need to do in order to have the authority to inspect their public buildings, hospitals, and nursing homes. Number two, it gives building officials a chance to correct any shortcomings that the Department of Labor identifies when reviewing local departments. Number three, it provides a clear appeals process if necessary. And finally, it excludes small projects from the delegation process. Now, my testifiers are here today to answer questions. We've come up with a compromise. I think everyone's satisfied with it. We're open to questions.
Thank you, Representative McNamer. We're done at 2, so you're fully warned. Who would like to go first?
Mike Jacobson. I work for the City of Benson and City of Morris, State Certified Building Official. I'm here representing Southwest Chapter of Minnesota Building Officials. We're a chapter that runs from where I work, probably Morris on the north end, all the way down Laverne Pipestone, along the southern side of the state to Fairmont, and then up to Litchfield. There's probably 30 of us out there. And we're just kind of all in favor of the bill. We're all looking for a little clarity in how this process works.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative McNamer for carrying this bill for us, and also want to thank the Department of Labor and Industry, and Mr. Rakowski sitting over there. When I first looked at this issue, I heard some concerns expressed from building officials across the state, and it certainly appeared to have the possibility to be a contentious issue. I'm happy to say that from the first conversation we had with Dolly, all of the discussions were very positive and very cooperative. And what we've come up with, which is in the A1 amendment, is a slightly different process that labor and industry will follow when they decide whether to delegate authority to inspect certain buildings to local officials. Under current law, labor and industry shall enter into an agreement for a certified building official to inspect hospitals, nursing homes, and public buildings if Dolly determines that they're adequately trained and have adequate staff. And it was that determination process which created some questions from our officials. And so working with labor and industry, we've come up with a process where the expectations of Dolly will be clear. They'll be provided in writing to officials before Dolly performs their audits. If Dolly determines that if they do not grant the authority to inspect these buildings, they will provide the reasons in writing, and the building official will have a chance to cure any shortcomings. If there is a bigger dispute, it sets out a very clear process, giving the local building official the opportunity to appeal it to the commissioner and then through the standard contested case process if necessary. And then it also excludes a number of projects which are listed on the beginning of page 3 from this delegation process entirely. This list came from Dolly, and they are projects that are very simple or routine, and this just makes a distinction between perhaps the new construction of a hospital versus a remodel of the administrative wing of a hospital, which really isn't a specialized type of inspection. So we're very happy with it. We really think it will help increase the trust between state and local officials and get that relationship moving forward in a very positive direction. Thank you.
John, do you want to talk?
Yep. Would the person from the Department of Labor and Industry care to step down and affirm the fact that you've been in negotiations and come up with a really supportable bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Rakowski, Director of Government Affairs for Labor and Industry. And when I heard about this bill at the end of last year from Mr. Hines, the original language was something we weren't able to agree to. So we had a series of meetings along with representatives from AMBO, Association of Minnesota Building Officials, and came up with the language that you see before you. And some of you were in the Labor Committee this morning when we did the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, authored by your chairman. And this process very much mirrors the same kind of compromise process, negotiations that we do in that council. So that's all I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Are there any questions by the members? All right. Are you guys ready for mine? I was kind of looking for an explanation of what your bill did. It doesn't quite, from a quick reading of it, essentially what it's saying is that the department has to give you in writing reasons why they don't want you to inspect. Is that what I'm reading here?
Mr. Chairman, essentially that's correct. Before these delegation decisions were made much more informally, and that was something that the building officials wanted in writing, so we agreed to that.
And top of page 3, mm-hmm. are those the roof covering replacement that does not add a roof load through 1 through 8? Are those that the projects that the local inspectors inspect without any questions from the Department of Labor and Industry, or are those the ones that Labor and Industry would inspect? I didn't quite catch that.
Those are the ones that the local building officials would inspect, correct?
And then
the list came from our department, however.
Okay. Could somebody explain Section 4, Subdivision 2C, the municipal fees?
Okay. I'll reserve that for Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry, I neglected to explain one thing that would clarify probably a number of questions. When the amendment was drafted by council, nonpartisan staff, they decided to restructure Subdivision 2 in a number of ways. And so if you look at the bill, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, 7, and 8, I believe, and council can correct me if I'm wrong, this language was deleted on page 1 and simply reinserted, and council on the Senate side just made it into subparagraphs. So none of that language, starting with Section 4, is different from current law or has anything to do with what we've worked on Dolly with. It was just the nonpartisan staff's desire to rework the section while we were in it.
So, thank you, Mr. Hines. What you're saying is Section 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are all current law. They're just being moved from one section of the statute books to another?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Unless there's one of the sections that is not. Maybe council can verify.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is actually an amendment that was put on in the Senate, so it reflects Senate council restructuring. But I guess I would probably Mr. Rakowski would be the proper person to respond to the fee question on the fees that are charged and the surcharge and who holds those on the current law versus what's in this.
But otherwise, Ms. Newman, this is just repositioning language. That's why it's underlined. Sections 5 through 8.
Mr. Chair, the underlying with these new subdivision designations with the revisor system, that is how even existing language has to be portrayed if it's moved from somewhere. I have not, however, gone through and verified that all this language is exactly in current law.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. With the fee language, I believe the language on line 1.11 through the word facility on line 1.15 is the language that now appears under the new title municipal fees on line 3.15 to 3.20. Now there some of that I believe is different because it has to reference the new subdivision 2B, but that's essentially that language, and I think the only change is just a necessary change to reflect that we added a new subdivision.
Thank you. Any other questions from the Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to your question about the written explanation for deficiencies and so forth on lines 2.18 and 2.20. It's kind of open-ended, having done some work in permitting and so forth myself. Would it be advantageous to the cities and so forth to have some sort of a window there as to the timeline for when that letter from the commissioner would be given to them? It's something that you should maybe consider as the bill moves forward. I would encourage you to do that so that it doesn't become open-ended and we have some definite...
Take them 5 years to write the letter?
Well, you never know. Representative, if I may, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
No. Thank you, Representative McNamara. I think this is a good bill. It allows our local officials to do what they do best, which is take care of their problems. Thank you.
Having had the A1 amendment explained to me, I hold codes pretty near and dear to my heart, so I typically would have adopted this to get it in the order that an author would like. I want to hear the explanation first. So I will renew my motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is on. And we are laying this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, having said that, we don't have to do anything further with it. Thank you for coming down. I know it's a long drive from us, but hopefully the weather was nice, and you, like me, you kind of go to that happy place and enjoy the scenery.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney and committee.
Thank you. I want to make sure all members are aware that we are coming back at 6 o'clock tonight in room 5. The who? Any freshmen? Are you looking for dinner? Yeah, okay. Chocolate dinner, fine, you know, whichever, same thing. Dessert. So, members, the committee stands in recess till 6 o'clock in room 5 tonight. Thank you. We're going to call this committee back to order. We had a quorum earlier, so we can move bills right now. We are going to make a change in the order. We are going to have Representative Hortman present her bill, House File 2543. Representative Hortman, where does your bill have to go to?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe Commerce, Civil Law. Oh, we're going all over the place, but we're going to go to Civil Law next.
Civil Law. So we will. The motion will be to re-refer House File 2543 to Civil Law. And we have one section in this bill that deals with deed. Which section is that?
Mr. Chair, I have with me today Kirk Kadelka from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and he will present that section. I believe it is Section 12.
Section 12. When it deals with first stop from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, if I remember right.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the hearing and the author for carrying the bill for us. It is correct. Section 12 deals with Minnesota Business First Stop, which is headed up by DEED, but all the regulatory agencies are also a part of it. As a collective, we work to make sure that we can answer folks' questions and find ways to bring businesses to Minnesota. One of those roles is to be able to provide assistance to them early on in the process, even before they're in the application process and move through that area. And so there were changes allowing for that to happen in previous years. We'd like to expand that to make it closer to our expedited process, which is a fee-for-service through the MPCA, which will allow for when they need to be able to get quicker service if they would like. To date, MPCA has not charged anyone for this, but if we were to get in a very large amount, we would like to be able to react quickly and bring on the staff that's needed.
Okay. And I'm looking at the correct one. On page 17, line 22, reimbursements by, that's still section 12, isn't it? Yep. Could you just go over that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and committee members, 17.22, which you're referring to, is just to make sure folks understand that by using the expedited process, that does not mean that no matter what they turn in, that they will get a permit. They still have to follow the laws and regulations under the federal and state law.
Okay. Any questions on this bill? Representative Metzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering how this would affect the industry up in my neck of the woods.
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it would depend if they want to opt in. This is an entirely an opt-in process. One of the industries on the Iron Range is the mining companies, and they do a lot of work on pre-feasibility before they even get in, just to see if it's worth them applying for. And the agencies, DNR and PCA, work together. They actually have a different process. There was some money that was gone through the tax bill last year to have dedicated PCA and DNR staff to do this kind of work already.
Follow-up?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know it was, what, $1.5 million on the occupation tax that we did that?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe it may be $1 million starting this fiscal year.
One. And
last
question, Mr. Chair. Was that helpful, or do you perceive it that it will be helpful in helping the mining industry with their permitting?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, the DNR and PCA are already starting to coordinate on hiring on additional staff, such as hydrologists, that can be used in both areas to get the biggest bang for the buck and sharing resources.
Is that it?
Yep.
All right. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr.
You
Chair.
Know, you know, you didn't say anything all last year, and now you announce you're going to leave, and you've got to... No, never mind.
Luck on it. Most of the things we did last year, however, I think we did together. Question. My question has to do with reasonable costs. Like over on page 17. And it kind of follows along the lines of previous question. You know, what's this going to do in terms of costs, especially in my district and throughout the state? Can you address that, please?
Mr. Kadok.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the First Start Office is a voluntary program. No one needs to do it. It's if the service that is provided already with the agency, they would like to move in addition and get additional resources to their project, there would be this option. Right now, this is like our expedited process, or which we do with environmental review. We charge for the actual costs of the staff work that's done.
Yes, please. In addition, are these additionary costs that you're addressing here in this section? Additional costs, I should say, on top of what you're normally charging?
Mr. Chair and committee members, right now, when in our expedited process outside this, so far the PCA has not charged any additional costs at all for this voluntary piece through deed. What would happen is, for instance, we'll use an example. If an industry comes together, ethanol industry, six plants or something all come together and they're asking for increased service and want to hit while the iron's hot, we will be able to provide a basic level of service. If they want to move even faster and would like us to hire more staff or dedicate staff to that effort, this would allow us that ability, instead of charging everyone a cost, to be able to meet that need. So it is voluntary. Again, it's not required of anyone.
Right. Well, I'm starting to have a different feeling about what you're planning on doing. And this would all be run through our Commissioner of Deed. So how does that work? How do you interact? Because usually you don't. Well, maybe you actually do, but can you tell me, can you briefly go through that?
I'm not sure what the question was, but if you do, go ahead, Mr. Cadell.
Sure. Mr. Chair and committee members.
Well, can I? Mr. Chair? Okay. All right.
Sure. What Minnesota Business First Stop is pulled together by deed, and we all have representatives, agencies on that group together. And then depending on what type of business comes in, if it's something that may not interact with the PCA, we won't be at the table. If it is a company that came in looking to turn in an old paper mill into a recycled paper mill, they bring us in. And so that's how we have that coordination to make sure the needs are met depending on the project. And that coordination in our case is done on the division director level, which is called in on that case.
Okay. That explains it enough to see how you're invoked into the system under this Minnesota Business First Stop, I guess. And if that's what we're calling it, this is a new program, right? Is this new? No, it's not new?
Mr. Representative Leiter, no, that's been around for a good number of years, and it's, well, not a good number of years, but a few years, and it's been a pretty successful group with when they brought all of them together. And I think it's not much more than two, maybe 3 years old at the most. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Do you need to?
I think it's worth it for...
Are you Representative Metza?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, basically, we made the investment last year and passed for that extra funding. And I think one of the real important things for us as a committee to know is that when you're making a hire, whether it be temporary or long-term, hopefully more long-term in the case where we invested the $1 million appropriation moving forward annually, that these are people who are interested in... I guess, participating in the permitting process at the agency, and it does take a long time to build up expertise. So I think having a more long-term strategy versus a short-term is a good plan, and, you know, basically just want to point that out for Representative Leiter.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening. Well, having been involved a little bit in permitting over the past few years, I am curious to know a couple of things. Currently under the current system, the dollars that are collected in penalties and so forth, where do those go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, you came in a couple minutes after we started, and the chair was very clear. He wanted us to only cover Section 12. I don't know, I think, though, that you might be on Representative Wagenius's committee,
yes,
which might be our last stop with this bill. And I think we could talk about that at that point.
Thank you, Representative Hartman. You're willing to wait till I thank you for waiting till Representative Hartman, Wagenius's committee, which probably would have more expertise on it anyhow, so they'll be able to give you a better, fuller answer. Seeing no other questions. All those in favor, I will renew my motion that House File 2543 be referred to civil law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. You're on your way. And I think we got you out of here in time for your other errand. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Norton is likely still in. How long is that one going to take?
I can go ahead.
All right. Representative Dean, would you like to step up to the plate? What is our page? Yeah. She's getting a signature. She's got him signed. Tell her to sign Norton and tell her she's got about 5 minutes. Okay? Architecture. Engineer, land survey? All right. Well, there's nobody that has that particular distinction on the committee, so I guess I'll move. Where are you heading off to? You're going to... Oh, we're going to lay this over? Oh, yeah, it actually is in my committee. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. Good to see you. Love the bow tie. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, first, let me start by apologizing. Last time I was here, I broke protocol, so today I got extra good cookies.
That's what I'm talking about.
And Ernie's already left. Well, they're not getting.
Need to share, Tony. Share.
Thank you, Representative Dean. All in favor of Representative Dean's bill? Please explain your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I probably won't do the best job explaining the bill, so today I have Dennis Martinson, who's one of the engineers and board members of the Alphabet Board regarding licensure. So I'll turn it over to him.
Well, Mr. Martinson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dennis Martinson. I'm a professional engineer, member on the Board of Licensure, and I'm accompanied today by members of the board, the Executive Director, Doreen Frost, behind me, and public member, Carl Peterson. The board we represent is a Minnesota licensing agency that protects public health, safety, and welfare by providing a reasonable assurance that any architect, engineer, land surveyor, landscape architect, geoscientist, or interior designer in Minnesota is a competent, ethical practitioner with the necessary knowledge and skills appropriate to their title and role. The bill in front of you today originated from members participating in national dialogue on ethics among the organizations that examine and license our professional licensees, calling for improvement and integration of ethics in professional practice and taking examinations. This discussion was brought to the board, and outreach began in 2009 on ethics, teaching licensees how Minnesota statutes and rules govern and call for ethics in professional practice in all phases for obtaining licensure. The board decided it was time to dedicate some of the required continuing education credits to ethics education, which is already required in many other professions in the state of Minnesota. In preparing the legislation, the board also identified a few other areas that needed to be addressed, including strengthening and clarifying the Practice Act and the cleanup of some obsolete language. You have in your materials a one-page summary of the proposed changes in the bill, in this bill. First, Minnesota law currently requires licensees to complete 24 hours of continuing education every 2 years. The legislation proposes dedicating two out of those 24 hours to be on ethics. We believe it is noteworthy that the board has discussed this issue extensively and has obtained the support of all the professional societies whose disciplines are governed by the board. That is the Board of Licensure. Next, the legislation strengthens and clarifies the Practice Act by limiting the use of the designation PE only by professional engineers. This is the standard designation and use of PE across the country. This rule will serve the public welfare by eliminating confusion that can arise from those who use PE to mean project engineer or principal engineer. The legislation clarifies the practice of land surveying to eliminate public confusion. One other change in the bill will require licensees to keep up their continuing education paperwork for 4 years rather than the current two to help them to be able to substantiate their continuing education if audited. Finally, we are taking the opportunity to clean up obsolete language. For instance, eliminate past dates or references to old accrediting bodies that no longer exist. Eliminate obsolete board duties, such as the development of exam questions. I might add, these are currently done by the discipline's national boards that are licensed under the board of registration. In short, this bill provides clarity on a number of levels and is good for the public and the professions. Thank you for your attention, and we'll now stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mortensen, right? Yes. Martinson, sorry.
Yes, thank you.
It seems pretty straightforward. I guess I have one question. When you talk about 2 hours must be dedicated to professional ethics, is there a standard that you're using? Is there a classroom, or is there, what kind of ethics training?
There's no specific, like a course, for example, but it's training in ethics. In other states, for example, I'm also registered in the state of Wisconsin as a professional engineer, and they just recently put that into effect there also, that you have some type of continuing ethics education. Some of these types of materials are available through universities, for example, or colleges, also through professional associations to which many of the licensees are members.
So, Mr. Martinson, you don't have a particular set of ethics, so it's not ethics as it pertains to finances or ethics as it pertains to helping little old men across the street. You're not setting any standard, or is the board going to deal with that a little later?
I don't know if you want to further. The executive director might be able to further clarify that, but basically it's, look, for example, I'm a professional engineer, so it's ethics related to my practice. And in fact, every applicant to become registered in the state of Minnesota signs a two-page ethics form that is part of the application for registration.
And you know what, I don't want to get too deep into this. Many of those ethics statements that we signed, they had us pipe fitters sign them too. I always like, it had part in there that you had to be a person of good character. and that was wide ranging. So all I'm asking is, and I don't want to get too deep into it, is just where are you going with your ethics training? So if you can answer that question, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carl Peterson. I'm a public member, and I'm also a CPA, and we have the ethics requirements for us as well. And really, it's looking to further education on ethical behavior and practices amongst the professions and how they operate. It isn't necessarily specific to one part of ethics. And I think all the organizations probably sign an ethics just like you do and I do, and it's really to further, and you know, as you get into practice, we're seeing, for us, education about the bad stories, right? And yep. So there's going to be ethical education on that to make sure that you are practicing in the best possible way.
Yeah, all those baby boomers are going to be really dependent upon financial people as we get older. And it might be something for the board to take up. I'm not going to take up any more time just to give it some thought of where what kind of ethics training you would like. Are there any other questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you. I see in the terms professional engineer, what does that pertain to? I have a number of relatives in the engineering professions, whether it be civil, mechanical, electrical, and I'm just wondering what professional engineer really denotes under the definition here.
Mr. Martinson.
In the state of Minnesota, Mr. Representative, it would be somebody who's licensed by the board, but it could be somebody licensed in any one of the engineering practices that come under the broad category of professional engineer with the board of registration in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Albright.
Thank you. So one of my cousins who is a civil engineer went to school in North Dakota but lives in Minnesota and works in Iowa. I also note that you're changing your continuing education credits not to include those used or earned in another state. Is that correct?
I was not aware of it. I'm not sure how that was interpreted, but that is not correct to my understanding.
Okay.
Representative Albright, do you have a line that you see that, a page and a line that you see that at?
The repealer, sir? The repealer? Continuing 326.107, you're repealing the continuing education.
Yes. So, how about if I ask the question this way? You have the repealer on the last page, page 1R. What you're repealing it for a reason? What are you replacing it with?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I hate to say it, we don't recall what was being repealed.
Do you have a copy of it with you?
I don't have a copy of the original with the cross out.
Oh, no, it's section 326.107. It's written on, it's the appendix on the end of the bill.
Oh, it is. I'm sorry.
And I'm sure I'm sure you replaced it with something in the bill or some other place it's being picked up. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good evening. I'm Doreen Frost. I'm the executive director of the licensure board. Thank
nice
you, Representative
to see
Mahoney. And the repealer that we have is for continuing education. We do accept everyone else's continuing education. What this does as it relates to ethics is say that if those other states do not have ethics, they must have the 2 hours of ethics for their renewal for licensure in the state of Minnesota. So, for example, the state of Texas requires an idiosyncrasy that they have on, California. California requires continuing ed on seismic. There are sometimes quirks in what states have for their continuing education. By repealing this, we are not automatically taking it. We used to do it if any other state had continuing education, we would take it. We will now take it, but they do need to have the 2 hours of ethics as part of the renewal.
Representative Albright, do you have another question? Because otherwise I've got an idea here.
Thank you.
This is being laid over, and I'm a bit unclear with the repealer. I read it while we were eating cookies. And it seems a little odd. So if you would be so kind as to figure out what you're replacing that repealer with, unless you know it right off the top of your head. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Part of this, as continuing education has only been in place in Minnesota since 2001, and it used to be that if you were licensed in any other jurisdiction, you could just check a box and you didn't need to supply any of the supporting documentation. This will remove that check a box kind of scenario, so it'll indicate that you have to indicate to the state licensing board on their form that you've taken the ethics. So it says how you don't have to complete the entire renewal form. You'll now have to indicate that you have taken the ethics.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Newman, would you like to comment on this at all? Probably not, but I'm going to ask you to.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I stepped over to point out to you, the professional development or continuing education requirements are already in.
What page in line?
What's it on, five?
Mr. Chair and members, it's on of the bill, it's on page 5 in section 8 is the existing language, and that's where they have brought in the new ethics requirement into the existing professional development language.
And Representative Albright, was your concern?
Well, the inferences are they still going to accept continuing education that's earned outside of the state?
Correct. In order to be able to take the license test here in the state of Minnesota, is that what your question is?
Correct, sir.
So do you follow where we're going with this?
I do, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, yes, we already do. There is no state specific that you have to be physically present or in any other state. The only other state in the union that currently does that is the state of Florida.
There's no other state that requires you to have a license?
No, it has to be that you have to have it, that you don't take other states' continuing education. Florida has some quirks in it, but we do accept other people's continuing education.
No, I think you're missing the question here.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir.
So, just as I read this, if I have a license in Wisconsin,
yes,
and I want to get licensed in Minnesota, and I got educated in Wisconsin,
yeah,
do all of my educational credits from Wisconsin, not my renewal, but my educational credits and the license that I held in Wisconsin, can I come over to Minnesota and take the test? I think that's where you were going, am I correct?
I don't read it anywhere that it stipulates they will accept those credits.
Yeah, and then Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, if I could speak to this. I know a little bit about professional licensing because of my involvement within the profession of architecture. What we're addressing here today is related to continuing education requirements. So your question regarding your education in Wisconsin to apply for a license in Minnesota is covered in a different statute.
Okay.
And all 50 states, believe it or not, have little quirks that are different, and oftentimes, you know, there's national organizations that try to do reciprocal license to help facilitate that to make it easier. So, I mean, specifically today, we're not looking at the actual education requirements prior to testing or whatever is required to be licensure. It's really looking at continuing education requirements. And for most professions, where you earn your continuing education isn't relevant, except in the case of Florida.
Okay. And I will look up later where that licensing, education, and everything else is. But I think, does that clear it up for you, Representative Albright?
For now, thank you.
Okay. I would suggest that you dig out that language and make sure that Representative Albright sees where it is. Somebody. Are there any other questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Metz and I are part of a group that's called the International Legislators Forum, and we meet yearly. Last year we met in Winnipeg with jurisdiction representation from South Dakota, North Dakota, Manitoba, and Minnesota. And one of the topics of discussion was, you know, kind of this cross-jurisdictional availability of professionals and people that can do pipe fitting and people that can do architecture and so forth. I'm concerned that are we doing something here in this bill that when you live where I live in the northwest corner of the state, we may be getting architects or engineers or land surveyors that come from Grand Forks, North Dakota, or wherever to do work in Minnesota. Are we making it
easier to do that, or are we making it more difficult to do that?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, if you're licensed in the state of Minnesota, you would be required to get the added ethics, not the added, you would need to have at least the hours required for ethics continuing education in the state, for your license in the state of Minnesota to maintain it. So you're the engineer that might be in Winnipeg, he also has to be licensed in Minnesota to practice in Minnesota.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I guess what I'm looking for here then, to kind of segue off of that, is does this requirement for ethics sync up with what they need to do in Manitoba or what they need to do in North Dakota? And if their license expires now, and I'm not sure what the date of enactment is, I'm sorry I haven't looked at that, but are we going to then somehow create a situation that's going to make it difficult for them to all of a sudden catch up so that they can continue coming down? You mentioned Winnipeg, number 10 architectural group in Winnipeg comes down and does the architecture work for the Roseau High School, and they've done it for years and years and years. Are we inadvertently creating a hardship that all of a sudden they're going to say, sorry, you can't do this, and we have a good working relationship with them? So do we have, are we synced up? What does North Dakota require? What does Manitoba require? So that we can...
Wow. Yeah, you got that on the top of your head? Representative Dean.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. I don't know the exact requirements in Canada. I don't know the exact requirements in North Dakota. We could certainly look that up. You use the example of an architect, which is probably a bad example, because architects have had ethics as part of their continuing education for quite some time. So the issue of someone having their license lapse, that becomes a whole different issue relative to renewing, to reestablishing your license and going through the process. Oftentimes what many states will do is if your license lapse, depending on the state, you may have to go through the whole process of actually taking your exam again prior to licensure, depending on the length of time. And I'm sure that Ms. Frost might be able to speak to that directly on some of the specifics, because my point of view is primarily from engineering and architecture, and I can't speak to geoscience, interior design, and some of the other professions that are covered within this legislation.
You care to add to that, Ms. Frost?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, actually Minnesota has a lower standard of the number of continuing educations. Our biggest group of licensees happens to be professional engineers, and I believe we have approximately 12,000 licensees. They're not all here in Minnesota. This national standard for the number of continuing education hours for professional engineers in the country is 30. When continuing ed went into place in the state of Minnesota in 2001, the Minnesota Government Engineers Council didn't want the higher standard to be at 30 because the majority of them hold one license. It's very common for professional engineers in particular, and architects as well, to hold multiple licenses in multiple jurisdictions, to answer your question. But we require 24 in the state of Minnesota, and many of the states require 30. So a lot of licensees in Minnesota that only hold a Minnesota license, if they want to go somewhere else, will have to maintain a higher number of credits.
So somebody's disappointing Lake Wobegon. Further questions? Okay. Any other? Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's more of a point of clarification. I did, in my former life, I was an associate publisher of a land surveying magazine called The American Surveyor, which is distributed throughout Minnesota here to every licensed land surveyor in the state. And I think some of the questions you were asking, Representative Fabian, would be, we do offer online courses currently, so a lot of these professionals, whether it be the land surveyors, we have professional engineers who received our publication as well, would have the ability to easily, through an online course, be able to meet some of the state requirements. My understanding in reading this would be that all it would require is the 2 hour or 2 days of ethics,
2 hours.
Or 2 hours, I'm sorry, of the ethics side of that versus a lot of the other things. And so they would be able to do a lot of this online from their homes, to renew their current licenses as is currently available, with the addition of the 2 hours in programs that would be required for this.
Representative Albright.
I think he just answered my question.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright?
For the author or for what would be the effective date of this bill then?
If there's no effective date list, well, I will ask the staff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, this is not an appropriation bill at this point, so it would be an August 1st effective date. Right.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, House File 2670 is going to be laid over for inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Dean. And you really redeemed yourself, I do want you to know. And if anyone, unless you're taking them with, that they're still there, you know, have at it, everyone.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. And I think there's about 6 or 7 cookies left, so feel free.
Representative Norton. What? You wanted one more cookie?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to move the bill, or would you care to do it?
No, you're in your committee. You may as well move it for possible inclusion.
I would like to move House File 2650 for possible inclusion in the Jobs and Economic Development Omnibus Bill or other bill that has a different name that does the same thing.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Would you care to speak to your bill? I know Mr. Hancock is here, and he has a really great story to tell, but if you've got a few words to go, go for it.
I don't need to take a lot of time.
You've been talking a lot today.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is an appropriation, and as I understand it, there are some groups that have been meeting for years that have made recommendations about how we want to move the SILS along. And this appropriation will help move us in that direction. And I think you'll hear that they're hoping for $500,000 per SIL across the state of Minnesota, and I think perhaps even looking to add another one for some underserved areas. But I will let our testifier go into the details and tell his exciting story and not bore the committee any longer.
We'll leave that up
Thank
to me.
You for
I'll leave that up to you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. And members, thank you as well for the opportunity to come and spend a little time with you this evening. My name is David Hancock, and I'm the Executive Director at the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. And I'm also the Chair of the statewide Minnesota Association of Centers for Independent Living, President of the Board. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time with you this morning talking a little bit about the impacts of 2650 and the services of the Centers for Independent Living. But I want to begin by saying, Mr. Chair, had I known, I would have baked a cake. I had no idea. But next time...
Motion to adjourn.
Well, understand that Representative Dean's bill was a relatively simple bill, and he brought cookies, and everybody got a little sugared up and went after
it.
I want to be careful.
So I'm hoping
fruit.
Maybe that'll translate into a lot of questions for me then, right? Yeah. I know that several members of the committee are familiar with the Centers for Independent Living and our work, but if you'll...
We will indulge you. You do great.
If you'll indulge me just a little bit, I'd just like to share a little bit of background information about the centers and then talk more specifically about House File 2650, and would also begin by noting that the Senate file is at 2640, so just for reference in case anyone's interested. There are 8 Centers for Independent Living in the state of Minnesota. The Centers for Independent Living, or SILS as we call them, are private, nonprofit, 501c community-based resource organizations and centers that are in place to provide those community-based resources for individuals with all types of disabilities. One of the unique qualities that sets the Centers for Independent Living apart from other service providers is that we don't serve just one constituency group. We provide services for individuals with all types of disabilities of any age group, any socioeconomic background, etc. We do not provide residential services. That's often a misnomer that we have to correct up front. We don't operate residential services. We don't provide group homes. We don't provide any other type of institutional type setting.
all of the services that we provide at the eight Centers for Independent Living are specifically designed to prevent out-of-home placements. There are services that are in place to enable individuals to continue living in their own homes of their choice in the community. In federal fiscal year 2013, the eight Centers for Independent Living located across Minnesota collectively served over 72,000 individuals with disabilities, including, and if I'll just take a moment to point out a couple of the outstanding or what I consider highlight services, 280 individuals with disabilities across Minnesota were assisted to relocate out of nursing homes and other institutional settings. Now, I point that out because the relocation of those 280 individuals creates a wonderful cost avoidance for the state of Minnesota. By relocating individuals out of nursing homes and other institutional settings, that actually translates to about a $23 million savings, or cost avoidance, if you will, for the state of Minnesota. Even after we reduce from that the price that it costs to support those individuals in community-based settings in homes of their own choice, the savings is still around $15 million. Several years ago, one of your colleagues here in the House said to me, you know, Dave, he said, every time somebody comes to visit me, they come in with an idea into my office that they have this wonderful new idea or initiative that will actually save money. And he said, don't tell me how you're going to save me money. Tell me how you're going to earn me money. So in that one service alone, just the nursing home relocation service, we're earning the state of Minnesota approximately $15 million that is absorbed elsewhere in the state. So we think that's worth tooting our horn about. 62,000 Minnesotans with disabilities received information referral and assistance services last year. And I point that out because in the Centers for Independent Living, providing our IRNA services is not just as simple as providing somebody with a phone number and sending them on their way. We spend an intensive amount of time with individuals, you know, drilling down to the core of the issue that they're trying to resolve in their life, making sure that they're connected with community-based resources and services, making sure that they're moving along in their pathway in a successful way. We assisted more than 1,800 individuals with specific advocacy needs and issues. An example of that might be someone who's having difficulty obtaining an accessibility or an accommodation from an employer. So we'll work with that individual to gather the resources they need to make a stronger and more successful argument with that employer. Or we may go with them and hold their hand, but we always make sure that it's the consumer's voice that's being heard. We provide a wide range of services to veterans with disabilities across the eight Centers for Independent Living. We served more than 1,000 young people with disabilities in transition age services, helping them prepare effectively for life after high school. We provided more than 830 home modification and ramp projects for individuals with disabilities across Minnesota. And in our very, very successful collaboration with Vocational Rehabilitation that allows us to actually embed IL specialists in each of the workforce centers around the state of Minnesota, we serve more than 2,000 individuals collaboratively with VR. And I know that the director of VR, Kim Peck, is in the audience tonight, and I know that she would endorse that success as well. So that's just to highlight a few elements of the services. The handout that I provided you on page, let me look it up here real quick, on page 5, there's a little bit more detail of the different types of services that were provided. And I'll let you read that at your leisure and be happy to respond to any questions that you have. But to move on to the specifics of the bill, as Representative Norton pointed out, the success of House File 2650 would actually enable the Centers for Independent Living to come into agreement and compliance with the State Plan for Independent Living, or the SPIL, as we call it. The SPIL is created on a 3-year cycle, and the SPIL is designed by the Statewide Independent Living Council with input from consumers, people who are themselves individuals with disabilities, family members, representatives from the Centers for Independent Living, State Services for the Blind, and Rehab Services come together collectively to create this long-range planning document. In this document, in its last several cycles, there has been a recommendation of a $500,000 minimum funding level for each of the eight Centers for Independent Living in Minnesota. It's determined that that $500,000 is what would allow the centers to effectively meet the needs in their service catchment area. And each of the, as you saw on the map on the front here, each of the Centers for Independent Living serves a multi-county region. Once each of those eight current centers receives that $500,000 minimum base in combined federal and state dollars, we would then look at the next phase of the plan, which would be to close up these gap areas, and perhaps by developing a couple of new centers, et cetera. So the spirit behind this bill is to appropriate additional funds that would allow us to meet that $500,000 combined state and federal allocation and bring us into compliance with the state plan. In addition to those participants who come together to create the state plan, it is then approved by those participating parties and is signed off. There's a sign-off on that plan by the Federal Rehab Services Administration. So it really becomes a federal document, if you will. Again, by supporting 2650 and the increased allocation that we're requesting, we would come into compliance with the spill and would bring each of those centers up to that $500,000 recommended minimum level in state and federal funding. I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, so I'll stop now and invite questions, Mr. Chair, if you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Hancock. You know, I've watched your services over the last 15, you know, as long as I've been here. If you came in here and rambled a little bit, you would, with the work that you and your organization does, you would be forgiven.
Thank you, sir.
Are there any questions for this particular bill? Representative Albright?
Thank you. Mr. Hancock's on page 5.
Yes, sir.
All of the definitions are very clearly laid out except for one, and I may be missing it, but about halfway down on the listing, there's one for 903 instances of a PAS.
Mr. Chair, Hancock. Representative Albright, that is personal attendance services, so personal care attendants.
Okay.
Those are individuals that assist people in their home with personal needs,
okay,
you know, et cetera.
Mr. Hancock, do you do any work with the deaf and hard of hearing?
Mr. Chair, yes, we provide collaborative services, so anybody with any type of disability is eligible for services at the Centers for Independent Living, and we often find ourselves collaborating with other organizations like Deaf and Hard of Hearing, the Epilepsy Society, the ARCS, et cetera. So we collaborate with a wide range of organizations to provide and meet the service needs of individuals.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair and members, if you'll give me just a moment of latitude, I want to say that the Southeast Minnesota SIL was this committee funded a very small grant, about $60,000, if you'll recall.
$68,000,
not that you are holding a grudge. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was very generous, and it has been used, and that's what I want to just take this opportunity, because we're sitting here with a SIL. Vicky Dolly Molly collaborated with, which is what prompted me to say this, our local parents of children with Asperger's and high-functioning autism, and we got a small grant that funded an FTE and probably just one FTE. And I had a parent call me just the other day to say her son was number 21 that's been serviced by that one FTE. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how long people stay employed, but the idea was to help these high functioning autism people that aren't children, they're as we mentioned, kind of the transition age and up to adult, keep employment. And so so far it looks like 21 is a pretty high number for one FTE of getting people employed and keeping them in the workforce, but I look forward to the year end report from that group. But I just thought I'd take the opportunity to update you. You did a good thing, and I hope we have good results for you.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can dovetail on that just very briefly, one of the things that I mentioned in my remarks, the collaboration that the Centers for Independent Living are involved in right now with vocational rehabilitation, and that collaboration which allows us to place independent living specialists in the workforce centers for right now availability to individuals who are job seekers. One of the things that we have found, and this is data that's been reported by the Department of Employment and Economic Development, I'm not producing this data, they are, but we're showing that through that collaboration, we're finding that there's the success rate for positive employment outcomes is around 67-68% for individuals who participate in that collaboration. For individuals, and not a criticism of VR, but for individuals who pursue just a straight VR experience, the success rate is about 14 points lower. So we know, for example, that the kind of collaborations that we engage in, like Representative Norton has discussed, that they're very successful because we bring that community-based direct service opportunity to the individuals. So.
Representative Albright, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the bill itself, on line 1.9, the last sentence that says, this appropriation is added to the base. I just need to know what the base amount is.
The current base, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the current base, if you look at the page 4 of the handout, the current base is 2.261 in state dollars. And then there's a contribution of federal dollars of 1.1.
So this would raise that to roughly the...
brings us up to about $2,952,652.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Are there any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, we are looking for we are looking to put together a an appropriate an omnibus bill. I'm not sure if there's going to be space. I would love to, because I know your work. I have one quick question.
Yes, sir. You
brought up the number 72,000, and I'm looking on page 5. That's just a that's a total of all the clients in that list, correct?
Yes, sir.
So a total of 72,000 clients, and 62,000 are referrals, the IR?
Mr. Chair, yes. Just under 72,000 is the grand total, and 61,745 IRNAs.
Okay.
Yes, sir. And if I may, just briefly, one of the reasons why that INR number is so high is because two of the centers in the state of Minnesota operate the Disability Linkage Line, which is a one-stop call center for any disability or chronic illness-related question that individuals might have. Like, so that really bumps those IRNA numbers up.
Chronic illness of running for election? Representative Fabian.
Never. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good bill. I was all good on this until we got to the last question that Representative Albright asked about the base and the 2.261. Mm-hmm. And then your following statement after that said for the fiscal year it brought it to what number?
The number in the bill.
Yeah. That's what I...
$2 million.
Yeah.
52.
Yeah.
So,
Mr. Chair,
so
I'm sorry. Please, sir.
Representative Fabian.
I just want to be clear. I mean, so I know that that's the number there that says for fiscal year 15, but in reality, if we're adding to the base, I mean, are we doing 700,000 or 2.? I'm sorry. I'm not an accountant.
Well, hold on a minute. Now, yes, I'm going to make sure that Harriet's listening to me.
Yeah.
If we were to do the $2,952,000 and this appropriation is added to the base,
but that's being considered of the full amount, not on the top of the 2.2.
It's not on the top. Correct.
So the appropriation.
And the base would go on $500,000.
Well, I have it calculated $691,000.
It's what?
$691,000.
Okay.
So that's added to the base, not the 2,952. So I think the nomenclature is just we've got to put a different number in there.
Yes. So I'm going to ask Harriet to explain what she just whispered to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way it's written, it would be in addition to the appropriation that was made last year. So the appropriation that was made last year is 2,261,000, and so that would the 2.9 something would be in addition to that.
And that would go on the base.
And that would go on the base, and so the total base would then be those two numbers combined.
It would be almost 5 million.
5 million, yes, correct.
And we can fix that. I think, was that your intent?
Our intent was, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fabian, our intent was that the new base would become the 2.9.
Okay, we can fix that in this bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry if it wasn't worded correctly.
Good catch.
But we would be adding the $691,652 to the current base.
You could probably put together a luxury apartment with that kind of money.
How did you know I was going there?
But I appreciate the clarification, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fabian. Thank you.
We'll fix this in the layover. Any other questions?
Thank you, sir.
Seeing none.
Well, if I had teacher.
I would like to renew House File 2650 to be laid over to be included in the omnibus jobs bill.
And even if we can't do anything this year, it's a good education for some of these freshmen.
Yes, sir, and Mr. Chair, if it's not capable this year, we'll be back next year.
Good, good. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Last bill of the night is House File 1866, which we'll be referring to government operations. As I understand it, Representative Isaacson is going to be presenting this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pinch hitting for Representative Morgan, who is at an all-important parent-teacher conference for his children.
Well, that's good. And there is an amendment in the packet, I believe.
Yep.
Or it's being handed out now.
It should be being handed out right now. All right. It's an author's amendment. Has it been moved, or do you need me to move it?
Well, I'm going to wait till it gets handed out.
But the bill has been moved. Rup.
Okay. Why don't you wait till we get the amendment out, and then you can move the bill, and then we'll do the amendment.
Good luck.
And Representative Newton, I just want you to know there's cookies right there that were brought by Representative Dean. All right. Okay.
I'm good.
Okay. I think we all have the everyone have the amendment? Okay. Representative Eisen, would you like to move House File 1866?
For pass to government ops, yes.
To be re-referred to government operations?
Yes.
Okay. And would you... I'm told there's an oral amendment on your amendment.
Yes, the amendment was written to a previous version that had been amended in a previous committee, so it just needs to be... Was it... Abu, was it...
I can read it for you. So, members, I'll make the motion that on line 1.2, the second 4 is deleted and insert 5. On page 1, line 3, the 4 is deleted and 5 is inserted. So it would read, line 1.2 would, page 4, delete section 5 and insert. Then on line 1.3, it would be section 5, repeal it. Everyone got that one? Mm-hmm. All right. Would you like to move the A4 amendment?
Yes, sir.
All those in favor of the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The bill is in the shape that you would like it. I'm sure you can explain it, and then we will pepper you with questions.
I'm looking forward to it. Try to cut down on the cookies so we can get through this tonight. This is simply an on-session bill. The portion of this bill that relates to jobs is focused on two areas. One is there is an advisory committee to the to Commerce and Deed. The Deed Advisory Committee is supposed to assist the commissioner and selecting organizations receiving matching grants for youth training, and that committee no longer meets. Commerce had one as well that was, they testified in the bill, they supported it. And then my amendment we just added that also relates to jobs is a repeal of an advisory committee to the IRRB, and that advisory committee is just simply as redundant. And if you want, I'd be happy to repeal of an advisory committee to the IRRB, and that advisory committee is just simply as redundant. And if you want, I'd be happy to have Commissioner Sertich up here to explain based on the look on your face. I'd be happy to do that.
It's always a good thing to have someone explain what the IRRB is trying to do.
And Mr. Chair,
Yes, Representative Metzger.
Thank you. I would just also like to point out that we let Ike do the, or Representative Isaacson do this because his wife is from Eveleth.
Apparently, my wife's a Ranger, so that's how I got permission.
Well, and she moved down here? I guess she's getting, never mind.
Yep.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Could you please could you explain the repealer?
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much. Tony Sertich, Commissioner of the IRRRB. So at the IRRRB, we have a few different funds that do economic development projects that are specified in tax law, and we have advisory committees of experts, bankers, other folks who look over our economic development projects and advise the board on the projects. We have these multiple boxes and multiple funds, but we really only need one advisory board to look over economic development projects. But under current law, we have an advisory board for every different fund. In essence, what we do right now is we appoint the same people to all the different advisory boards so they can handle it. And so that's how we get around the silliness of having multiple advisory boards. This would eliminate one of the advisory boards, but it wouldn't eliminate the function. We still have one advisory board that looks over all economic development projects.
Are there questions on that explanation? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, this is a non-session bill, mm-hmm. Commissioner. And so in some of the committees that I've sat on, we looked at and reviewed it on session bills, mm-hmm. we've talked about when these were put into law, mm-hmm. these committees or advisory councils or boards or commissions, You know offhand if there was a fiscal note for those, and the kind of the second part of that question is, you know, then if there are some savings related to the on-session work that is being done in this bill.
Representative, Commissioner Sertich.
No promise, Chair. I've been called worse. Mr. Chair and Representative, there is no fiscal note attached to this because. As I explained, these are advisory boards, and so there are citizens who come and volunteer of their time. They may get, you know, some mileage reimbursement, but there's going to be no savings because we put the same citizens on both advisory boards, so they're still going to come, and they're still going to advise us. We're just getting rid of one of the boards. And so there's no fiscal savings, and there's no fiscal savings getting rid of another advisory board that doesn't meet anymore. It's just getting rid of the language and cleaning up the books.
So,
just, Mr. Chair,
Representative Ward.
Just again, I appreciate that, and that's good explanation. And I think that's, you know, a worthwhile question, a worthwhile look at, you know, because oftentimes when we sit around these tables, and Commissioner, you sat here and heard the agencies come in and say, you know, we can't do this. If we do this, it's going to add this and this and this. There's a fiscal note for this, and there's a fiscal note for that.
Yep.
And so I really appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So, Commissioner Sertich, are these individuals that are appointed to these boards different than the legislators that are appointed to the IRRRB board?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. I appoint the folks on the advisory board, and these are citizens that have expertise in different businesses, expertise in banking and the like. So these are citizens that are separate of the board. The IRRRB, the board itself, is populated by legislators who have one-third of their legislative district in our Iron Range service area. And so those are elected officials making decisions on local property tax dollars, not state dollars. This is separate. This is an advisory board of local citizens who have expertise in economic development, in banking, in business.
So any past legislators on that those advisory committees?
Mr. Chair and Representative, none.
You're lucky man. Representative Metzger.
Mr. Chair, to that point, just for clarification as well, to my understanding, Commissioner, these people review the projects before us IRRRB board members even see what's coming down the pipeline for a check and balance, making sure that the citizen oversight is not proceeded by the legislators who sit on the board.
Any questions? Any other questions? Representative Albright, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Either for the author or for the commissioner, under the Regional Energy Research and Educational Partnership section. I note that this arrangement has been in existence since 2005, which is 8 years ago. So I'm curious. I have two questions, Mr. Chair. What's been going on for the last 8 years?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Isis.
Just so we're clear, are you referring to the advisory committees under the three energy? Right. So I was not there when we covered this. It wasn't in the area when we managed that, but he was very clear that in the room at the time, the combined expertise, nobody could ever remember if they've met. And so I'm pretty sure you have a valid question, but that's what they were saying.
Can I just back this up just a quick second? I'm wondering, and I'm going to ask staff here, what part of this bill, other than that repealer, deals with the Department of Employment or Economic Development or DOLE?
Mr. Chair, the Taconite Economic Development Fund, and I believe the explanation was that it was a deed advisory committee.
What page in line? Oh, I'm going to make you work.
Mr. Chair, did I misunderstand the question? Maybe I did.
I'm just trying to figure out what part of this bill needs to be heard in our committee.
I think I outlined that in the beginning. There were two parts. The first part has to do with deed. The second part has to do with the IIIRB.
Which was the first part? Page in line?
Thank you. So,
because I was looking at the House Research Overview, and I didn't see anything other than the repealer as I was looking at this. Oh, Real Estate Board. That section there.
This right here.
Okay. And I... The Real Estate Appraiser Advisory Board?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Newman.
I think perhaps the other link to this committee is in the existing repealer section of the bill. If you look, there's two sections in Chapter 116L that are repealed, and I believe that is the link to this committee, that those are the deed advisory groups that are repealed.
And do you know which advisory groups those are?
We
will in a minute.
Very quick.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Newman.
The references in the bill, the 116L.361 subdivision 2 reference is actually a definition of an advisory committee. And then the section 116L.363 reference is an advisory committee dealing with the youth build program.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Isaacson.
The notes that I've been handed when I agreed to take this over, and we had a small powwow about it earlier, was very clear that the only two parts that was the deed advisory committee is supposed to assist in the commission in selecting organizations to receive matching grants for youth training, and that committee no longer meets. Okay. That part is the one repealer. I'm sorry, I could not identify exactly which repeal it is in the link. I mean, I'm not sure what the number that correlates with that. And then the second part was the repealer that involves the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, then I guess what I'm wondering, just, you know, for the sake of the commissioner, I'm wondering where in the language of the statute is a citizen advisory committee preserved? I don't see it.
Commissioner Sertich.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, there is another advisory task force, the DJJ Advisory Task Force, and it's in the statute. I can try to grab a statute book here. It'd be 298. If you give us a minute, I'm sure I can find it. That's what's being repealed, but it's right next to it in the statute.
Okay. I'm just trying to make sure that we're not, you know, undoing something and understanding it.
That's fair. Yep. Absolutely. And for the record, my other understanding was the rest of this bill has been covered in other committees already.
Yeah. As I read the bill quickly, most of it's in Commerce, or
yep.
and the state and the GovOps part is just the board parts where they're going to go right. through it. So I just want to make sure what we're getting rid of before
maybe while they're looking at it, I do have another question for the author or the author.
Representative Albright, would you care to ask the author?
Thank you. Representative Isaacson, under that same area with regard to, and maybe this is all done, but it speaks to renewable energy, including hydrogen fuel cells and related technologies, and it's talking about state public research and higher education institutions. Could you specifically identify in terms of where that focus is going to be? Would it be with the land grant of the University of Minnesota? Is it with MinSCU? Is it with technical colleges? How are they interrelated? Is there one higher ed that is tasked with it, or is it just kind of a broad brush and you're just sprinkling the effort wherever it takes root?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Isaacson.
I would again, I have two answers. One, my best guess, based on the information I have from House Research, was, and they spoke of, and I will just quote the overview where it says, to assist partnership by established states public research and higher education institutions, so that would be either MinSCU or the University of Minnesota, to make Minnesota from Midwest a center of research and education with respect to hydrogen energy. This is the portion of the bill that when it went through Energy Commerce, that they were remarking that no one knows if this is actually ever met when it was done.
Representative Albright, I think it would be a bit, it's really not in the purview, our energy is not in our committee,
sure.
So it'd be a little unfair to the author
sure.
to,
a fair question.
Because he probably didn't bring any of that information with him. But Ms. Newman, did you figure out what we're getting rid of?
Mr. Chair, in the bill, what is being the taconite or the 298.2213 reference in the bill is the Northeast Minnesota Economic Development Fund Advisory Committee.
Okay.
So that is what's being repealed. I didn't fully hear the conversation on the second advisory
Mr.
group.
Mr. Chair.
So.
Yeah.
Commissioner Sertich.
Yes. Thank you, and Representative Albright. If in 298.297, there's a section advisory committees, and there is still an advisory committee for economic development projects where the commissioner shall appoint a technical advisory committee consisting of one or more persons knowledgeable in the areas. So it's 298.297 would still be there for the advisory committee set up to do economic development projects. And I can show you the statute if you'd like to see it.
I'm just going to ask Ms. Newman if she concurs.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, the commissioner is correct. Section 298.297 is another advisory committee that is still in law.
And Mr. Chair, the commissioner, that's the one that is the one you want?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative, that's the one we want, and that one's staying. And we'll have an advisory committee. Thank you.
That's kind of, I served with Commissioner Sertich, and I've seen a couple of his grillings. I was kind of hoping he'd get, fried, but he apparently not here. So, oh, that was simple compared to what you. Oh, Representative Fabian. Don't go off on him. He's done. I think you can be excused, Commissioner.
Do this.
This is to either this would be to the author on line 2.6 and 2.10. The word should is in both of those lines. Institutions should work with, and down there on 2.10 it says the partnership should be designed. If my lovely wife were here, she would really be scratching her head with the word should. I mean, this is so loose. What is it?
Representative Fabian, I would suspect that that is one of the things that, I mean, Representative Kahn for a while was on the, made it a real priority for her to correct some of the shoulds and the mays to must and may. And I am shocked that she missed one. I am shocked.
Well, Mr. Chair, it just seems so warm and fuzzy, and it, I don't know. It doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
I would agree with you.
And I'm not necessarily advocating that it should be must or will
or shall.
I'm just saying I would like a little bit more information that actually leads me to believe that something constructive should come out of that.
The other piece to that. Well, one of the other pieces, Representative Fabian, and it is something that It takes a couple of times running into it. The University of Minnesota its charter is pre Minnesota State Constitution. So it is very hard. I don't know of many times that we can say they must, unless it's connected to money. They must do this in order to get this amount of money. But to say they must work with so-and-so or they must collaborate with this committee, we can't. We can say they should. We can say we wish you would. We can say any number of suggestions, but we can. It's pretty hard for us to say you shall. So that might be where that comes in. And I know it's grammatically, it can drive you crazy. Dear mother, long gone, was an English teacher, and she tried to beat it into me or teach me, and it didn't work. So with that, are there any other questions for the author? Representative Albright, we're going to cut you off from cookies.
I love them.
This is the last question by his dinner.
No. He's got McDonald's there. I'm not eating at McDonald's.
This might be for the author. It could be for the commissioner, but I just need clarification on page 3, line 3.9. It says the commissioner shall, and it goes on to enumerate any number of agencies, organizations, and cooperatives, associations, thereofs and thereons, for which they are to collect information and make recommendations and report their findings of fact back to the legislature and make recommendations as such. First question would be to who is the commissioner in question?
That would be the commissioner of commerce because it's an energy issue.
Thank you. And then I guess this is an op-ed question for which the author or the chair might answer. When was the last time that we received a report on these findings from the commissioner subject to this provision and statute?
This committee would never get one. We would never get one. It would go to the Energy Committee or the Committee on Commerce.
Okay.
Seeing no hands. Would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, sir.
The motion is re-referred to House File 1866 is re-referred to Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. We are done for the evening. We next meet on Tuesday, March 18th. So I tried to get it real early in the morning for the day after St. Patrick's Day.
Awesome.
But they wouldn't let me, so we'll be meeting at 12:30 our regular time.